A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been to the Jerusalem Wine Festival, found himself at the pomegranate wine booth like half the crowd, and came away wondering something that honestly bugged me too once I started thinking about it. Why does grape wine have a total monopoly on our sense of what wine even is? Has any non-grape wine ever broken through to genuine widespread popularity? And for those of us who've tasted pomegranate wine and want more, what are the actual bottles worth tracking down?
This is one of those questions where once you start pulling the thread, the whole sweater unravels. The scale disparity alone is staggering. Global grape wine production sits at about 260 million hectoliters annually. That's the latest OIV data from 2025. Best estimates put it under 50,000 hectoliters globally. That's a 5,000-to-1 ratio.
50,000 hectoliters is basically a rounding error in the wine world. That's like one medium-sized French cooperative spillage.
That's being generous. But before we even get into why, we should define terms because wine is a loaded word. Legally, in the EU and under USTTB regulations, wine means fermented grape juice. If you ferment pomegranates, you're making fruit wine or other fermented beverage. You can't even label it as wine without qualifiers in most markets.
Which is already stacking the deck. The regulator has decided that grapes are wine and everything else is a weird cousin.
Right, and that's not arbitrary. It reflects a genuine chemical advantage grapes have. But culturally, wine predates that legal definition by about 8,000 years. Fruit wines, mead, palm wine, rice wine, these are older than grape wine in a lot of regions. The oldest known fermented beverage is actually a mixed drink of rice, honey, and fruit from Jiahu in China, dating to around 7000 BCE. Grapes came later.
Grape wine didn't win because it was first. It won because it was. Better at being a product.
Better at being a standardized, exportable, shelf-stable product. Grapes have this almost miraculous combination. Sugar content typically between 20 and 24 degrees Brix, which ferments to roughly 12 to 14% alcohol, enough to preserve the liquid without distillation. They have natural acidity that balances the alcohol and prevents spoilage. They have tannins from skins and seeds that provide structure and act as natural antioxidants. And the yeast that grows naturally on grape skins, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is basically the perfect fermentation organism.
Grapes arrived preloaded with the entire winemaking kit, the fruit equivalent of a turnkey business.
And most other fruits are missing at least one piece of that puzzle. Pomegranates, for instance, come in at 12 to 14 degrees, roughly half the sugar of wine grapes. You have to add sugar to get a reasonable alcohol level, a process called chaptalization. Their acidity is through the roof. And the tannins from pomegranate seeds are aggressively astringent. They require much more careful handling than grape tannins.
Pomegranate wine isn't just grape wine with different fruit. It's fighting the raw material at every step.
Paying more for the privilege. Pomegranates cost anywhere from $2 to $4 per fruit. Wine grapes run 50 cents to $2 per pound. You're starting with a more expensive input that's harder to work with, and the resulting product oxidizes faster. There's a 2023 study in food chemistry that found pomegranate wine loses about 40% of its anthocyanin content. Those are the color and antioxidant compounds, within 12 months of bottling. Red grape wine loses about 15% in the same period.
It fades faster, costs more to make, and the law won't even let you call it wine without an asterisk. This is the business equivalent of showing up to a Formula One race on a bicycle.
Yet, there are non-grape wines that have broken through. Let's talk about the exceptions, because they're instructive.
I need some good news after that pomegranate reality check.
The biggest success story, depending on how you define the category, is sake. About 7 million hectoliters produced annually, global distribution, premium bottles selling for hundreds of dollars. Sake's export value hit 70 billion yen in 2025. That's about $470 million, up 40% from 2020. It's riding the sushi wave and premiumization trend hard.
Does sake count? It's not fermented from fruit, it's brewed. Rice starch gets converted to sugar, then fermented. That's structurally closer to beer.
This is exactly the debate. The rice wine label is basically a Western marketing convenience. Sake is brewed, not pressed from fruit. The production method is fundamentally different. But culturally, it occupies the same space as wine. It's served alongside food. It's discussed in terms of terroir and rice variety and water source. It has vintage variation. I'd argue it's wine-adjacent enough to count as a genuine exception, but the chemistry says it's a different thing entirely.
Sake is the honorary wine that's actually a beer that nobody wants to call a beer.
Actually, not wrong. The clearer success story in the actual fermented fruit juice category is hard cider. About 25 million hectoliters globally, with strong regional dominance in the UK, France, and the US Pacific Northwest. Angry Orchard alone sold 5 million cases in 2023.
5 million cases of fermented apple juice. That's not niche. That's a real industry.
Cider succeeded where other fruit wines didn't, because apples solved the grape problem from a different angle. Apples grow in temperate climates where grapes struggle. Normandy, Brittany, the West Country in England, the Pacific Northwest. They're cheaper to grow than grapes. And historically, cider was the working class drink in regions where wine was for the wealthy. It built cultural roots that pomegranate wine never had.
Also, apples are cheap. You're not paying $2 to $4 per apple.
The input cost is fundamentally different, and apple varieties bred specifically for cider. Bittersweets and bittersharps have tannin and acid profiles that mimic wine grapes in useful ways. It's not an accident that cider succeeded. It found its ecological and economic niche.
How did that actually play out historically? Was cider always the underdog, or did it have moments of genuine dominance?
There were absolutely periods where cider was the dominant beverage. In 14th century England, orchard planting was actively encouraged by landowners because cider kept the agricultural workforce fed and hydrated. The alcohol content made it safer than water, and the apples could be grown on land that wasn't suitable for grain. By the 17th century, cider was so culturally embedded in the West Country that workers were partially paid in it. There are labor contracts from the 1600s specifying daily cider rations of 4 to 6 pints per worker. That's not a niche product, that's a staple.
4 to 6 pints a day? That workforce was either extremely cheerful or extremely asleep.
The alcohol content was lower than modern ciders, probably 3 to 5%, but yes, it was a different relationship to alcohol entirely. The point is that cider had centuries to build infrastructure, develop regional apple varieties, and embed itself in local identity. Pomegranate wine has had none of that runway. It's trying to launch into a mature market with no historical infrastructure behind it.
Then there's mead, which is having a moment but still hasn't gone mainstream.
Mead is fascinating because it's arguably the oldest alcoholic beverage humans ever made. Honey ferments naturally when it gets wet, so it probably predates any deliberate brewing. But it's still under 1% of the global wine market. The barrier is honey cost. Honey runs $3 to $5 per pound versus grapes at 50 cents to $1.50. You're paying 5 to 10 times more for your fermentable sugar.
Honey doesn't scale the way grapes do. You can't plant more bees.
You can, but apiary scaling is genuinely harder than vineyard scaling. Honey production depends on forage availability, weather, colony health. It's a complex agricultural product, not a monocrop. So mead will probably always be premium and niche, which is fine, that's its identity, but it's never going to compete with grape wine on volume.
What's the actual scale of the mead industry right now? You said under 1%, but what does that look like in real numbers?
The American Mead Makers Association reported about 500 meaderies in the U.S. as of 2024, up from maybe 30 in the year 2000. So the growth curve is steep, but the base was tiny. Total U.S. mead production is probably around 50 to 60,000 hectoliters annually. That's less than 1% of U.S. craft beer production, and craft beer itself is a fraction of total beer. So mead is a niche within a niche within a niche within a niche.
It's the Russian nesting doll of fermented beverages.
Yet the people in mead are optimistic because the growth trajectory is real. New meaderies are opening, distribution is expanding, and the product is shedding its Renaissance fair image. There are now meads winning awards at mainstream wine competitions. But it's still a rounding error compared to any established category.
The exceptions are sake, which cheats by being a completely different process, cider, which found an ecological niche grapes couldn't fill and had centuries to build cultural roots, and mead, which is lovely but fundamentally can't scale. None of these are direct analogs for pomegranate wine.
That brings us to pomegranate specifically. Because pomegranate wine isn't trying to be the next cider, it's trying to be a premium, distinctive product in a world that's already decided wine means grapes. Let's talk about who's actually making pomegranate wine and whether any of it is worth the hunt.
I've had this stuff at the Jerusalem Wine Festival 3 years running, and I've never seen a bottle in a store. Who's making it?
The gold standard, no contest, is Ryman Winery in Israel. Founded in 2008, located in the Golan Heights, they produce 100% pomegranate wine, no grape blending, no shortcuts. They use the wonderful variety of pomegranate, which is the commercial standard. Deep red arils, good sugar content, consistent quality. Their flagship is called Ramon Classic, and it's a semi-dry wine at 13.5% alcohol, aged in French oak for 6 months.
6 months in French oak is serious. They're not treating this like a novelty fruit punch.
They're treating it like actual wine. And the industry has noticed. Ramon Classic won gold at the 2024 International Fruit Wine Competition. They produce about 15,000 bottles annually, which is tiny. A mid-sized Napa winery produces 50,000 cases. Ramon is producing 15,000 bottles total.
15,000 bottles for the entire global market. That's basically a rounding error squared.
That's the leading producer. The distribution picture is exactly what you'd expect. As of May 2026, no major distributor carries a pomegranate wine nationally in the U.S., not Southern Glazers, not RNDC. If you want Ryman wine, you order directly from their website. They ship to 48 U.S. states and most of Europe. Expect to pay $35 to $50 per bottle plus shipping.
$35 to $50 puts it in serious wine territory. That's not impulse buy pricing. That's, I researched this and specifically sorted out, pricing.
Which is appropriate for what it costs to make, but it's a barrier. And here's the thing, there have been attempts to go bigger. Let me tell you about Poma.
The pomegranate liqueur?
That's the one, and it's a cautionary tale. Poma launched in 2005 with $20 million in funding. Big rollout, big marketing push, cocktail culture was booming. They peaked at 150,000 cases in 2008. By 2012, they'd collapsed. Inconsistent product quality. Pomegranate concentrate varies wildly depending on source and processing. Supply chain issues. They were sourcing concentrate from Iran initially, and that became politically complicated. And the product itself was a liqueur, not a wine. So it was competing in the cordial space against Triple Sec and Chambord, where brand loyalty is entrenched. Poma still exists, but it's a shadow of what it was.
The one pomegranate alcohol product that had serious money behind it crashed because of supply chain and category confusion. That doesn't bode well.
Palm Wonderful, the juice company, tried their own wine experiment from 2010 to 2015. Limited release, never scaled, quietly discontinued. The pattern is consistent. Someone gets excited about pomegranate wine, invests, discovers the chemistry and economics are brutal, and retreats.
I want to pause on the Palm Wonderful thing for a second, because they had something that most pomegranate wine startups don't, their own supply chain. They literally own pomegranate orchards. If anyone could make the economics work, it should have been them.
That's exactly what makes their failure so instructive. Palm Wonderful controls something like 60% of the U.S. pomegranate market. They have the orchards, the processing facilities, the distribution relationships, and they still couldn't make wine work. The issue wasn't access to fruit. It was that the wine itself wasn't economically competitive with their core juice business. Every ton of pomegranates that went into wine was a ton that couldn't go into juice, where the margins were better and the shelf life problems didn't exist.
They had the vertical integration and it still didn't pencil out. That's almost worse than a supply chain problem. That's a fundamental business model problem. The most efficient use of a pomegranate is juice, not wine.
And juice is a much bigger market. The global pomegranate juice market is about $230 million annually and growing. Pomegranate wine is maybe a $2 to $3 million market total. If you're a rational actor with pomegranates to sell, you sell juice.
Yet Ramon is still standing. What are they doing differently?
They stayed small and focused on quality. They're not trying to compete with Cabernet. They're making a distinctive product for people who specifically want pomegranate wine. And they've gotten good at it. The oxidation problem I mentioned earlier, that 40% anthocyanin loss in 12 months, Ramon deals with that through careful oxygen management during fermentation and bottling, and by selling directly to consumers rather than sitting on retail shelves for a year.
The business model is make it well, sell it fast, and don't try to be something you're not.
And there are other small producers worth knowing about. There's a pomegranate winery in California producing about 2,000 cases annually. Armenia has a growing pomegranate wine scene. Pomegranates are a national symbol there, and the climate is ideal for the fruit. These are tiny operations, mostly selling at farmers markets and through tasting rooms.
What about the UK? I remember seeing something called pomegranate years ago.
Discontinued in 2022. Pomegranate was primarily a juice concentrate brand that experimented with a fermented product. The wine version had poor shelf stability. Pomegranate wine oxidizes about 3 times faster than grape wine, and the UK retail environment was not kind to it. Bottles were turning brown on shelves within months.
Turning brown on shelves is not the tasting note you want associated with your product.
It's the shelf life equivalent of a 1-star review, and this is the fundamental challenge that nobody has solved at scale. Pomegranate polyphenols are powerful antioxidants in the body, but they're highly reactive in the bottle. They grab oxygen and degrade. Grape wine has this beautiful equilibrium where tannins and anthocyanins polymerize slowly and actually improve with age for years. Does not do that.
Why is that, chemically? What's different about pomegranate polyphenols versus grape polyphenols?
It's partly structural. Grape anthocyanins tend to form complexes with other phenolic compounds, tannins, flavanols, that stabilize them. These complexes are what give aged red wine its brick red color and softer mouthfeel. Pomegranate anthocyanins are mostly in a less stable monomeric form. They haven't found partners to dance with, so they just fall apart. There's also an enzyme issue. Pomegranates contain higher levels of polyphenol oxidase, which is the same enzyme that makes apple slices turn brown when you cut them. Even after fermentation, residual enzyme activity can accelerate degradation.
It's not just one chemical problem. It's a structural stability problem and an enzyme problem working together.
The enzyme is particularly annoying because it's active even at low temperatures. You can slow it down with sulfur dioxide, which is standard in winemaking anyway, but you can't fully deactivate it without heat pasteurization, and heat pasteurization destroys the delicate aromatics you're trying to preserve. It's a catch, 22.
The product has a built-in expiration date that's shorter than grape wine. It costs more to make, and the raw material fights you. This is like a business school case study and maybe don't.
Yet, the people who love it really love it. The flavor profile is unique. It's got this bright, tangy acidity, deep ruby color, and a kind of earthy, almost savory quality that pairs beautifully with grilled meats, Middle Eastern food, hard cheeses. It's not just a novelty. There's a real sensory experience there that grape wine doesn't replicate.
I've had it with lamb kebabs at the festival, and I can confirm. It's not a gimmick. The tannins from the pomegranate seeds have this different kind of grip. It's sharper than grape tannin, more angular, but it works with the right food.
That's the thing about the misconception that fruit wines are just sweet, low-quality dessert wines. Ryman Classic is a dry, complex, structured wine. It's not alcoholic pomegranate juice. Proper pomegranate wine goes through full fermentation. All the sugar gets converted to alcohol, and then it's aged. The production process is structurally identical to grape wine. Ferment, press, age, bottle.
The fruit wines are sweet. Thing is just people who've only had, like, cheap blackberry wine at a county fair.
Which is most people's only exposure to fruit wine. And that's a branding problem, not a quality problem. The fruit wine industry has historically positioned itself as a novelty. Sweet, fruity, low alcohol, almost a wine cooler alternative. That's not what Ryman is doing, but it's the category they're lumped into.
It's the same problem that hard cider had for decades in the US. Everyone assumed it was either sickly sweet or basically apple juice with a tiny kick. It took a generation of craft cider makers to rebuild the category's reputation.
Cider had the advantage of being able to point to centuries of dry, traditional cider making in England and France. pomegranate wine doesn't have that heritage to draw on. There's no traditional method, pomegranate wine from the old country, that can serve as a reference point. It's inventing its tradition in real time.
For the listener who tried pomegranate wine at a festival and wants more, what's the actual playbook?
All right, here's the actionable advice. Option 1, go to Ramon Winery's website and order directly. $35 to $50 a bottle, they ship to 48 U.S. states and most of Europe. It's the best pomegranate wine on the market and worth the shipping cost if you're curious.
Option 2, for people who can't get Ryman or don't want to pay shipping.
Try pomegranate mead. It's called Pomelomel in mead, making circles. The honey base provides natural preservatives, so it's more shelf-stable than straight pomegranate wine. Redstone Meadery in Colorado makes a Pomelomel, and Chaucer's in California has a pomegranate mead. Both are easier to find than pomegranate wine and give you a similar flavor profile.
Option 3 for the DIY inclined.
Pomegranate wine is actually one of the easier fruit wines to make at home. The 2024 edition of The Complete Mead Maker, great book, deeply nerdy, has a recipe. 5 pounds of pomegranate arils per gallon, add sugar to bring the bricks up to about 22 degrees, use a neutral wine yeast like Lauvin D47. The arils are the seed casings inside the fruit, and you can buy them frozen or fresh. The hard part is just getting enough of them.
5 pounds of arils per gallon. That's a lot of pomegranates.
It's about 8 to 10 whole pomegranates per gallon. The labor of deseeding them is the real cost. But if you're the kind of person who finds that meditative rather than maddening, it's a fun project.
I'm trying to imagine Herman deseeding pomegranates for an afternoon, and I'm not seeing it.
I'd delegate. I have nephews.
There it is.
The broader point is that pomegranate wine exists at this strange intersection. The product can be excellent. The people making it are serious. But the economics and chemistry make scaling nearly impossible, and the distribution infrastructure doesn't exist, so you have to be a proactive consumer. You can't just wander into Total Wine and grab a bottle.
Which is kind of appealing in its own way. There's something nice about a product that requires effort to find. It's the opposite of algorithmic recommendation culture. You can't be passively served pomegranate wine.
That's the hipster framing, and I respect it. But it's also a genuine market failure. There's demand. The Jerusalem Wine Festival booth is packed every year. The product exists and is good. But the gap between, I tried this and loved it, and I can buy it, is a chasm.
What would it take to bridge that chasm? Is there a future where pomegranate wine breaks out?
There are a couple of interesting signals. The USDA allocated $2.5 million in 2025 for alternative fruit wine research. That's not nothing. It suggests institutional interest in diversifying beyond grapes. And climate change is reshaping the wine map in ways that could open doors for fruit wines.
Explain that connection.
Grape-growing regions are shifting northward as temperatures rise. Bordeaux varieties are now viable in southern England. That was unthinkable 30 years ago. Champagne houses are buying land in Sussex. As traditional wine regions face heat stress and water scarcity, some of them may become better suited to other fruits. Pomegranates, for instance, thrive in hot, dry climates. They're drought-tolerant. They don't need the precise temperature ranges that Pinot Noir demands.
The nightmare scenario for Burgundy might be the opening for pomegranate wine in places that used to be marginal.
Texas and Arizona are already seeing small-scale pomegranate wine production. Those regions face serious water constraints, and pomegranates use less water than grapes. The 2025 USDA grant program specifically mentions alternative fruits as a climate adaptation strategy.
That's an interesting knock-on effect. Climate change doesn't just move grape regions. It might change what wine means.
There's a cultural dimension, too. The natural wine movement has primed consumers to expect variety and funkiness and regional specificity. People who drink orange wine and pet nat are not going to be scandalized by pomegranate wine. The audience for weird, small-batch fermented beverages is bigger than it's ever been.
Weird fermented beverages are basically a lifestyle brand now. Kombucha normalized the idea that your drink can be tart and funky and alive.
Pomegranate wine fits into that landscape more naturally than it would have 20 years ago, when wine culture was more rigidly hierarchical. The gatekeepers have less power. A small producer can build a direct-to-consumer following through social media and online sales without ever getting into a distributor's catalog.
The barriers are real, but the landscape is shifting. The oxidation problem is still the big one, though. Has anyone made progress on that?
The food chemistry study I mentioned identified some potential solutions. Microoxygenation techniques borrowed from grape winemaking, specific yeast strains that produce more protective compounds during fermentation, and bottle conditioning under nitrogen. But none of these are silver bullets. The 40% anthocyanin loss in 12 months is a fundamental chemical reality. You can manage it, but you can't eliminate it.
Pomegranate wine will probably always be a drink now product, not a seller forever product.
Which is fine for most consumers. Most wine is consumed within 24 hours of purchase. The aging fetish is a tiny fraction of the market. But it matters for prestige. Wines that can age command higher prices and more respect. Pomegranate wine can't play that game.
It's the musical equivalent of a band that only releases singles, never albums. Perfectly valid, but the industry doesn't quite know how to talk about it.
The industry's vocabulary is built around grape wine. The language of tannin structure, aging potential, vintage variation, it all assumes grapes. Fruit wine producers have to either adopt that language awkwardly or invent their own.
I wonder if that's actually an opportunity. If you're making pomegranate wine, you're never going to win on the grape wine scorecard. So why play that game at all? Why not develop a completely different vocabulary? Talk about brightness, freshness, the way the acidity hits, the specific food pairings that only work with pomegranate.
Some producers are trying exactly that. The Armenian pomegranate winemakers, in particular, lean hard into the cultural specificity. They talk about the fruit's role in Armenian identity, the particular microclimates where the pomegranates grow, the traditional uses of pomegranate in Armenian cuisine. It's a different storytelling framework entirely. Whether it works at scale is another question, but at least it's not trying to be a second-rate Cabernet.
All right, let's land this. What's the one-sentence answer to the prompt?
No non-grapefruit wine has achieved grape-level global dominance, but cider has genuine regional scale, sake has premium global reach, and pomegranate wine exists as a tiny, high-quality niche led by Ryman Winery in Israel. And if you want it, you're going to have to order it directly.
The one-sentence takeaway for the person who loved it at the festival.
Go to Ryman's website, expect to pay $35 to $50 a bottle, and drink it within a year. Or try a pomegranate mead if you want something easier to find.
The next time I'm at the Jerusalem Wine Festival, I'm going to look at that packed pomegranate booth differently. It's not just a quirky alternative. It's a tiny industry, fighting 8,000 years of grape hegemony with bad economics and worse chemistry.
Somehow making good wine anyway. That's worth supporting.
Where does this leave us for the future? I'm curious whether you think there's a breakout moment coming or whether pomegranate wine is permanently niche.
I think permanently niche, but that niche might get bigger. Climate adaptation, changing consumer tastes, direct-to-consumer sales channels, all of these help. But the fundamental cost structure isn't going to change. Pomegranates will always be more expensive than grapes per unit of fermentable sugar. The oxidation problem is manageable but not solvable, and the regulatory framework isn't going to suddenly embrace fruit wines as equals.
The ceiling is higher than it is now, but it's still a ceiling.
Every industry has those. The question is whether the ceiling is high enough to sustain serious producers. Ryman has been around since 2008. That's 17 years. They're surviving. Whether anyone can do it at 10 times their scale, I'm skeptical.
I'd love to be wrong. I'd love to walk into a store and see a pomegranate wine section, but I'm not holding my breath.
That's the tension at the heart of this whole topic. The product is good. The demand exists. But the gap between good product with demand and viable industry is filled with chemistry problems and distribution failures and regulatory indifference. It's a classic market structure story.
The pomegranate wine industry is basically a really talented musician who can't get a record deal because the recording studio is optimized for a different instrument.
The instrument is grapes. It's always grapes.
So, next time you're at a wine festival, skip the Cabernet and try the pomegranate. You're supporting a tiny industry that deserves to exist, and you might discover something distinctive. And if you want to go deeper, order a bottle from Ryman and invite some friends over for lamb kebabs.
That's the most actionable advice we've given all episode. I stand by it.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the late Victorian period, a cookware manufacturer in the Aral Sea Basin produced a line of pots made from compressed Saiga antelope horn, marketed under the name Keratinware. The material was prized for its natural non-stick properties, but was discontinued after saiga populations collapsed in the 1890s.
Compressed antelope horn cookware.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this ship afloat. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other curious people find the show. Find more at My Weird Prompts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.